This time on Watchers of Tomorrow, we adventure into space with a Starship Enterprise as we visit the planet M113 and look for some salty adventures.
Hello, my name is Gepwin, and as always, I am joined here by Dr. Izzix.
Hi!
And as you heard in our cold open, which is a thing that I'm liking to try out, we're doing the first episode of Star Trek.
Yes, the very first episode of Star Trek that showed up on the TV screens in 1966, featuring the crew of the Enterprise, the USS Enterprise, the Federation starship sent into deep space to go exploring and occasionally visiting colonies and random people that live on planets.
Yes, and this is a random people on planets episode.
Yep.
So this is the first episode to broadcast. It is called Man Trap.
Mm-hmm. Broadcast on September 8th of 66, thousands of years ago.
This was actually broadcast during their preview week, which is why Star Trek had really good ratings for the first episode, because they actually premiered it a week earlier than any other network was premiering their shows.
Nice. So it's like everyone's like, well, there's new shows on today. Let's go turn them on.
Yes. And,
was this on CBS or?
This was NBC. Because Living Color.
Color. This was very colorful.
Yes. So as you won't be able to see it in the podcast form, but if you are watching along with us or see any of the old Star Trek episodes from the original series, like, keep in mind, this was selling color televisions.
Yes. See, you know, most folks are still dealing with the black and white, but it's like, you know, you could get more out of it because we now have shows that are actually in color. So go out to your store over there, go to your Sears, pick up a new color TV, and start watching this new show. It's real neat.
Yes, and they had it on NBC specifically because NBC had a premier color network. So they were one of like all color, all the time networks, which is why the logo was the peacock.
Do, do, do.
Exactly. So I suppose we should jump in with a synopsis before we go into too much more, 20 minutes on television history.
Yes. So where are we? What's our captain's log here?
All right. Captain's log. Enterprise is under the temporary command of Mr. Spock. Cut to the first time we see Mr. Spock on the bridge. Kirk and McCoy are to beam down to planet M13 on routine medical examination of a Dr. Robert Crater and his wife, Nancy.
And when I wrote that down in my notes, it was Crator!
Yeah, like Dr. Morpheus.
Yes.
Kirk then tells us that this would be an incredibly routine mission if it weren't for the fact that Nancy is the one woman from McCoy's past. McCoy is apparently very lonely.
Yes, the only woman in his past.
McCoy and Kirk and random crewmen came down to planet M113.
I think his name was Darnell.
Yes. He has Darnell, but I keep calling him, I was calling him random crewman because who cares?
Now it's important to point out that he's wearing a blue shirt.
Yes, the red shirt trope had apparently not been introduced yet at this point.
Yes.
Oh, after McCoy and Kirk engage in some witty banter that is supposed to connect them in our minds as old friends, McCoy gives us exposition and explains that the woman they are about to meet is someone that he knew 10 years ago. He and Kirk are interrupted by weird music, which I'm kind of unclear on whether we hear or they hear. But they seem to react to it.
Well, this is also the 60s. When people just sort of react in general to things, the music cues happen.
True.
So since it is the 60s, they're probably hearing the music.
And Nancy Crater, a young woman with black hair, enters the room.
Mm-hmm. So she's a little young for someone who's an old friend of McCoy's, and because he looks like he's already like in his 50s, right?
Yes. He very much does. She greets McCoy, and then he introduces her to Kirk, And this is the first time we get to see Kirk's signature close-up beauty lighting. After the introduction Sparkles. To Kirk, the camera cuts back to Nancy, and she appears older, with gray hair and a different hairstyle.
Oh, my.
Yes, the musical cue tells us that this is, in fact, odd.
Yes, it's important. You should be paying attention.
She is then introduced to the random cannon fodder crewman, Darnell, at which point she appears to be a completely different younger blonde woman who yes. gives Darnell a very flirty up-and-down seductress look.
Yes, she wants something that Darnell has, if you know what I mean.
Kirk notes that Darnell is staring at her awkwardly and asks if something is wrong, at which point Darnell proceeds to be creepy.
A little bit, but, you know, sometimes, you know, from Kirk's perspective, he's probably thinking, all right, she's probably not someone I would go after, but Darnell maybe has different preferences than me.
Yes, you know. For Kirk, it's a little weird to chastise someone for staring at alien women. Darnell creepily compares Nancy to a woman that he left behind on Wrigley's pleasure planet, which I guess is the equivalent to Risa, if you're familiar with yes. Next Generation.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, Wrigley's is similar to Risa, believe it or not. Sorry, I had to go there.
McCoy gets visibly upset by this, and Kirk sends Darnell outside to stop being a creep.
Well, that only kind of works.
Yes.
Because, you know, Nancy's gone her way that way in a little bit.
Yes, after talking to Kirk and McCoy, where Nancy continues to change form depending on who she was just talking to, she leaves the room to find her husband, and outside, blonde Nancy continues flirting with Darnell, who was waiting by the doorway.
Yes, in a place that it's kind of obvious, given the arrangement of the architecture, that McCoy can probably see that if he just turned it around.
That's
turned around
true.
And looked. Probably could hear them, too.
Yes, I actually didn't think of that. That's a good point. It's like, because it is a right straight here. Hallway that goes directly into the room where McCoy is.
And there's some flirting. She's being really super sassy. And Darnell's like, oh, yes.
Some suspenseful music plays as they walk away. And we fade into our opening credits. Sounded like Speaks. You were going to start the Game of Thrones theme for a minute there.
Well, I could go into a quick reading of the lyrics for the theme song.
Okay, yes, we actually didn't cover the lyrics for the theme song.
In our first episode there. So the lyrics, which aren't present in the show, it just Roddenberry wrote these because he wanted royalties.
Yes.
Go like this. Beyond the rim of the starlight, my love is wandering in starflight. I know he'll find in star clusters reaches love strange like a star woman teaches. I know his journey never ends, never. Sorry. His Star Trek will go on forever. But tell him while he wanders his starry sea. Remember me.
Oh, good God.
Isn't it so cheesy?
Yes. I've never heard anyone try to sing it before. That may be an internet first.
I think there's a few versions floating around there, but I think like one was done by Tenacious D. Maybe one by somebody way back actually in the 60s. That was my interpretation. I'm sorry.
So just to fill in the history, the only place this ever actually appeared was on the music sheet version of the Star Trek theme that you could buy for, like, you know, compilations for piano and such mm-hmm. that you could buy at music stores. Roddenberry wrote this because there was a loophole in the contract that they had with the person who did the original theme that they were allowed to add lyrics to it at a later time, and whoever added the lyrics got 50% of the royalties every time that they played the song.
And so Roddenberry is like, well, we're going to be showing this a lot, so might as well.
Exactly. Oh, and since we're at credits, I forgot to ask. This is one of the first times that we got to see all the effects. Did you watch the remastered versions?
I believe I did. Yes, watching remastered versions. I was watching them through the Amazon Prime dealio, okay. So it's the version they got.
Yeah, I was watching the Netflix version, so that's interesting. I didn't know they were both the remastered ones. But yeah, the effects on the remastered ones are actually really good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I still enjoy the old original effects, but you know, the new ones are actually pretty good. Still has the same feel, and it's a little less blurry.
Yes. I enjoyed the HD. So, you know, Netflix and Amazon has good versions of these.
Yes. It's also the version I think that's floating around on like BBC America, which I see sometimes. They seem to play a lot of Star Trek on there.
Well, what else they got?
Doctor Who, but, you know.
Yeah. Hey, once we are back to the show, Robert Crater enters, Nancy's aforementioned husband. He immediately insults Kirk and McCoy and tells them to leave him alone.
As you do.
And then immediately demands additional supplies of salt, saying it's the only thing that they need.
He's feeling salty, you could say.
Kirk informs Crater that researchers working off-planet must submit to a physical every year.
You must submit!
And he finally sits down to be scanned. This is an interesting one because Kirk specifically mentions that this is like boring for everyone.
Yep.
So it's kind of just this. It is actually a good representation of them going into kind of Starfleet duties, and they're like Star Trek goes into a lot of kind of duty ethics and do your duty, the militaristic outfit. It's like, we need to do these specific things whether or not we feel that they are justified or right or whatever, because they are the rules.
Yeah, so it's just, in some ways, kind of interesting, given that sort of in the long run, Roddenberry was sort of kind of resistant of Starfleet sort of being overly militarized, but still they still have this work ethic sort of, you know, duty sort of structure built in even from the very get-go.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it's shown as a, you know, mundane task rather than a, like, you know, the rules say we have to do this thing, but it's going to hurt someone. It's just the rules say we have to do this thing, and it's boring.
Yep. It's like, this is an everyday job for us. It just, you know, everyone has to get up in the morning. They have to go drive to work. They have to go scan some colonists over there, you know, whatever.
Yes. So during the small talk, Crater explains that he is actually very, very happy that his wife has some old friends visiting, because while he is perfectly happy living in complete isolation on this planet, you know how women are.
Oh my. Ooh.
Yes.
Yep.
This episode doesn't get better on women from here.
Nope, not at all. It gets really, really awkward.
Yes. Moy exclaims his amazement at how young Nancy looks. Kirk,
she looks like she's 25.
Kirk then says there's absolutely no way she looks that young at all.
Kirk's like, what the hell?
Yes.
Are you guys blind? Come on.
Crater then explains that when they see her again, Nancy will appear a more appropriate age.
One way or another.
The discussion is interrupted as Nancy screams. Thank you. Kirk runs out of the room, gun drawn.
Oh, no.
To find Nancy standing over the crewman Darnell.
Yep.
Who is lying dead with red circles all over his face.
Yeah, Darnell done died. Whoops. Yes. Is what I have in my notes.
It's a good synopsis.
No. Here's an important first, though, for the, you know, there's an important line here that. It forms the a meme, a trope of Star Trek, especially the original series. This is the first "he's dead" Jim.
Yes, though it's not given the same any dramatic weight. Like, I missed it the first time I watched through. It's so sad.
You know, it's just a, you know, quick line. Yeah, it's something easy to miss.
Kirk removes a green plant from Darnell's mouth, and Crater tells Kirk that Darnell was an idiot who eats poisonous plants on alien planets. And that's why he's dead.
You know, that's a thing that apparently Star Trek officers do sometimes for some reason.
Yes, because this
that makes sense.
This is like kind of believed. This isn't immediately like, challenged. Well, I guess you're right. He ate a poison plant, dumb crewman.
It's like, yes, Darnell, this professional we've been working with for some time, apparently, is just sort of going to put things in his mouth. And especially when the conversation goes on from there, where she's like, no, don't do it. Don't eat the thing. And he did it anyway. It's like, okay, what?
Yes. As Nancy explains that this is a Borgia plant, and she just noticed Darnell holding one, and before she could do anything, he takes a bite and dies immediately.
Oh no!
Kirk and McCoy get ready to beam back up to the ship with the dead crewman, and before they leave, Nancy once again reminds them that they need additional salt supplies.
Yes, get us some salt.
Back on the ship, we meet Uhura and Spock. This is the first time we've seen these characters outside of the brief little cutaway in at the beginning of the episode.
Yes.
Uhura.
Spock is unhappy.
Yes. Uhura engages in awkward flirtation with Mr. Spock, who is very confused by this.
Yep.
Now, this isn't. Like, is this the first time these two have met?
I think, as far as, you know, the show order goes, I think so, yeah.
As far as the show order goes, but it's just like, they know each other's names, but she just seems constantly confused that he is unemotional.
Yep. Have you not heard of Vulcan before?
Yes. Well, apparently not, because neither of them knows how many moons Vulcan has.
But, yeah, it's in the larger context, you know, we might be a little unfair about, okay, she doesn't know what a Vulcan is, what? But, yeah, this is also introducing Vulcans to the audience. So it does kind of make sense to have a scene like this sometime in one of the early episodes to sort of establish that Vulcans are kind of detached, emotionless, don't quite operate the same way as, you know, humans do.
True.
So this is actually a very useful scene for the audience, despite it being really awkward.
Yes, just so, so awkward and weird.
And, you know, there's also mention of Darnell's death.
Yes, the transporter room then calls and reports one death.
Gasp!
Yes, Uhura chides Spock for his lack of emotions regarding the death of one of the landing party, and even goes so far as to suggest that it could be the captain, who's the closest thing that Spock has to a friend. She's like, if it was the captain, I think they would have mentioned it. Spock explains that his being concerned would not be helpful to the situation. Just your good old Vulcan logic.
In a tactical sense, sort of. But
yes.
It would be kind of good to know who died at some point.
Yeah, eventually.
Yes.
We cut to the dispensary, which is apparently what they're calling sick bay. I don't know when and if that switches over in the original series. I guess I'm just used to sick bay.
Yes.
Spock informs Kirk and McCoy that the Borgia plant is a thing, and it is very similar to Earth's nightshade. It is, in fact, very poisonous, but it could not have caused the red mottling found on Darnell's face. McCoy said that his examination did not pull up any traces of poison, and that he, in fact, shouldn't even be dead, because he's found nothing medically wrong with him.
He's just sort of not alive anymore.
Yes. Which is this, I'm sorry, I don't want to get super nitpicky, but this trope has always bothered me in science fiction.
We don't know what happened. He's just not alive
anymore.
Yeah,
this doesn't happen. No matter what kills you, no matter what causes the initial death, like symptoms.
Be complications.
Yeah, something killed you. Your heart stopped, you had a heart attack, liver failure, just something stopped working to kill you. You don't die and everything looks fine.
It's like, yeah, you know, it's like, okay, your heart stopped because you had massive blood loss, or your heart stopped because it didn't have the, you know, raw energy in order to keep functioning. Something happened to cause your heart to stop.
Yes. And well, I don't want to get picky at all their stuff, but this is just one of those sci-fi tropes that always bugged me. Because I was a licensed EMT for a little while. I didn't get to do a lot of work in that area, but like, you know, this always bugged me, like having learned medicine. All right, McCoy attempts to then explain how he was seeing Nancy as much, much younger than she appeared, trying to solve the mystery of the frickin' show. Until Kirk yells at him for thinking with his junk and like tells him to get back to work.
McCoy, dude, a guy's dead. Deal with it.
Yes.
In my notes, I had a little more colorful language than that. Then there's a new captain's log.
Yes, there is a new captain's log, which I forgot to write down.
So it just basically gets us up to date, recaps what we've seen so far, and it's a message from the starship asking her, where the heck is the Enterprise? Or Starfleet, I think.
Yes, and he has to like tell someone that he's going to get his chili peppers later.
Yep. We'll go pick them up sometime, whatever. Just wait.
Yeah, which I didn't actually write down in the notes, but I did love that as kind of a little bit of world building.
Yes.
It was just kind of nice. Like, you know, yes, we have things to do after this. This isn't the only thing in the world. Like, we weren't planning to stay on this planet for 6 days doing a medical examination.
Just sort of happens sometimes.
Oh, later, Spock expositionized us about Crater's research. That he's been on the planet doing archaeological research for 5 years, but that his artifact and research shipments have declined over the last year.
Yeah, it's like not needing as much stuff. They're becoming self-sufficient? I don't know. They seem to be a little low on salt. But, you know.
McCoy calls Kirk to the dispensary because he has sensitive information he doesn't want to put on the main speaker. Mm-hmm. It is explained that Darnell died because all of the salt had been removed from his body.
Where did it go?
Kirk then remembers that both Craters mentioned needing salt when they were on the planet.
Mentioned the salt delivery. Time to go down and see what's up.
Kirk, McCoy, and a couple more randoms return to the planet in question.
You mean Ensign's soon-be-dead Gunnabite?
Yes. Kirk then starts questioning Crater, saying that he very much wants to solve the mystery of Darnell's death because he has a tummy ache.
Sounds a good enough reason as any.
Yeah. That was just the most awkward way to say that mysteries bother me.
It's like, I don't want this to be a thing anymore. I feel very vomit prone here. Go away.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even like, you know, I've heard, you know, mysteries give me a headache and I have a doozy. Yeah. But mysteries give me a stomachache and I have a doozy just sounds infinitely more awkward.
And generally more hilarious, too.
But, yes. Yeah. But I feel like that was unintentional.
We'll forgive them.
Yes. Crater runs off when Kirk demands that he and his wife stay on board the Enterprise. He then finds one of the random crewmen dead with the same red dots on his face. And he calls out to Nancy saying that he has salt, but runs away when Kirk and McCoy come looking for him. They then find the dead crewman and begin calling for the other random, Crewman Green. Who?
Yes, Crewman Green, where are you?
Yes.
Got a dead guy here. Green, where are you? Come on over. Stop being mystery and gone and not here and possibly massively in danger. Come back.
We as the audience have seen that Crewman Green is in fact dead, with Nancy standing over him.
I wonder if she has something to do with this.
Maybe. Nancy then uses the power of the crossfade to appear as Crewman Green.
She's in disguise.
Yes. She then, as Crewman Green, joins Kirk and McCoy as they return to the Enterprise. Green then begins to spend the majority of this episode in awkward close-up shots staring at people and licking his lips.
Yes. The creepy stalker, Stranger Danger vibe.
Yes, very sort of Stranger look. Danger, except it wasn't the 90s. So I don't know what they called Stranger Danger in the 60s.
Don't know what that would be called then. Flirting, maybe. Was the 60s.
Once on board, Green sees a blonde woman carrying a tray with weird alien vegetables and a salt shaker, which he seems immediately fixated on.
I'm going to go creep on the yeoman here, and can I, like, touch your salt shaker?
Yes. We are introduced to her as Janice.
Yep.
First name only. This is, in fact, Yeoman Rand, who appears later in the series, but we are only introduced to her as Janice, no title or other name.
I think it's mentioned Yeoman later, but yeah, it's sort of a side bit of chatter when there's obviously other things going on.
Yes. He creepily follows her into the elevator.
Yep.
And then creepily follows her down the hallway. Mm-hmm. That apparently all of this goes unnoticed because when she walks by two other crewmen in the hallway, they also creep on her and then turn to Monster Green and expect him to continue the creepy, yeah, wouldn't you like to have her bring you food?
It's like, everyone's really after Yeoman Rand here.
Yes.
And that's just sort of how things roll on the Enterprise, apparently.
Apparently. It is just, like, workplace harassment. They aren't playing it up in any kind of way. It's just workplace harassment.
Yeah. Apparently that's what the future has in store for us, apparently.
Yes. We are then introduced to Sulu.
Sulu! We're looking at Sulu! Sorry, I had to do that.
That's fine. Sulu, who is sitting in his random plant room.
Yeah, the botany lab.
They comment on an anemone-like plant. Mm-hmm. And then as Green enters, the anemone plant freaks out.
Yes, the puppet.
Yes.
The puppet plant is like, holy crap, I'm out of here.
Both Sulu and Janice comment on Green's odd behavior as he leaves, but apparently that's as far as they take it.
It's like, well, that was odd. How are you doing, Sulu?
Yes, exactly. So this sort of behavior is apparently not odd enough to comment upon.
Then again, as we just pointed out, everyone seems to be creeping on everybody. So
yes.
Apparently this is just normal behavior for Starfleet personnel, Sarah.
Apparently. In the hall, Green sees Uhura and transforms into a tall, handsome black man.
Yes. And he starts
who
talking.
He then says she was just thinking about. They engage in some not as awkward flirting.
Mm-hmm.
And then she is pinned against the wall, but is interrupted by the captain calling her over the intercom, and she gets away.
Yes. And he also talks some Swahili at her, which somewhere I had noted down what the translation for that was, but it was like, you're a very beautiful woman sort of stuff.
Wow.
And you'll never be alone, or something along those lines.
Now, this is the first and only time we see the monster creature turn into someone who is apparently not real.
Perhaps like a combination of various ideas that Uhura had in her head of people that's like, remember that one guy who's kind of this height? He was pretty cute, but if his eyes were better, it was a little bit more like that. Yeah, like that.
Mm.
Hey, that's the guy I'm thinking about there, huh? How weird.
Yes, very weird. But also apparently not worth commenting on until much later.
Yes, there's just this random guy here. I don't know.
We cut to McCoy, who is tossing and turning in bed. Mm-hmm. And he calls the bridge. Kirk tells him to take the little red pills that he gave him because those will knock him right out.
Makes him as, Mega Zoloft of the future or something.
Yes.
I don't actually know what, sleeping pill brands there are around right now.
Meanwhile, we see the monster find a random engineer in the hallway.
Mm-hmm. Some a guy in a radiation suit and starts stalking.
While Kirk, who is unable to find Nancy with the ship's scanners, prepares to beam back down to ask Crater what happened to his wife.
Bob, did you lose your wife again? We're looking for her.
But right before they do, Nancy, who is now back in her Nancy shape, mm-hmm. finds McCoy in his room. She also tells him that he should take the sleeping pills.
Take the pills, man. It'll be good for you. You'll sleep for hours.
Sulu and Janice, who are wandering down the hallway, find the body of the random engineer from earlier, also with red patches on his face.
Oh, no.
They call McCoy for a medical emergency, and Nancy then disguises herself as Dr. McCoy.
Nancy is secretly McCoy the whole time.
That would be more interesting.
See, that's the whole thing. She was McCoy the whole time. It was just an illusion to introduce confusion to the audience, right?
I hope.
No, that doesn't make any sense.
Otherwise, I don't see much point to this episode. Back on the planet, Kirk and Spock find Green's body, and they deduce that the pun who beamed up to the ship with them must have been a dangerous creature of some sort that is now targeting the Enterprise.
Oh, no.
They confront Crater, have an incredibly awkward gunfight with a lot of crawling and spinning and being in the dirt.
Action Man Kirk, away!
Exactly. They manage to stun him, which disorients him, makes it difficult for him to talk, and slows down his voice, and I am so glad that they don't keep using that.
Yes. By the way, in my notes, I had all sorts of things about dramatic music, set phasers to jazz, and then the professor being all, she's the last of her kind.
Yes. Crater informs them that his wife is actually dead, and that the creature that killed her was the last of its kind, much like the passenger pigeon or buffalo.
Oh, yeah. And so it's like, oh, wanted to preserve it sort of vibe going on here.
Apparently.
Despite, you know, the murder.
Yes. We can touch on this in a minute because we're only a couple paragraphs from the end. But yeah, I found this a weird late addition. And that the creature needs salt to survive. Which they keep saying like it's a novel idea.
It's like, well, yes, so do we.
Yes.
We need salt to survive ourselves. We need it in our food and our water and just in our bodies in general. It helps the chemistry work.
Yes. In the conference room, Kirk and the crew are discussing what to do about the creature on board the ship with Crater. McCoy, who is the creature, unbeknownst to them, is also sitting in the conference room while they're discussing it.
Yes, and McCoy suggests that there's a, you know, they've been setting out traps and things like that, and he suggests a non-trapped salt option.
Yes, the McCoy suggests that the creature seems to be intelligent and is only trying to feed itself, so why not just give it the salt that it wants, and then it will not be dangerous. This is apparently not considered.
Yep.
It says, they're just like, no, let's kill it.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems like a bad idea, McCoy. We don't even know you're, the bad guy yet. We just don't want to.
Yes, including, Spock goes, that's an interesting idea, McCoy, but no.
Logic dictates, nah.
Yeah. Which I'll get to in a minute, because this is a little... I don't know, this whole thing bugs me.
Yeah.
Crater talks up his relationship with the creature, and how it became the image of his wife. Kirk suggests that he's been living on his own personal pleasure planet, I guess?
His own personal, not quite Risa yet. What was it, Wrigley's?
Wrigley's, yes. Which is, that doesn't that sound like a, Dave and Buster's, some kind of gaming bar?
Well, maybe during this, this era of the Star Trek universe, that's their jam, scantily clad ladies, yes, but there's also going to be a poker.
And then that could be more interesting. Kirk demands that Crater give up the location of the creature, and when he refuses, he orders McCoy to use truth serum.
McCoy's like, okay.
Yeah, which, I didn't even know they had this. This seems unethical.
A little bit, especially since they came to this guy for a medical checkup. Sure, there's people dying, but under what jurisdiction and law are you being able to do this to a civilian?
Yes, just randomly. There's an awkward cut to commercial, after which we see Kirk running into the dispensary, where Spock has been attacked and Crater is dead.
Oh, no.
Yes. Apparently, just sort of out of nowhere, the creature returns to McCoy as Nancy and begins begging for her life because the crew is trying to kill her. Which is true.
Yeah. It's like, well, yes. Yeah.
Kirk enters, pulls a gun on Nancy. McCoy refuses to believe that Nancy is dangerous and grabs the phaser from Kirk.
Don't ever do that.
Is then threatened by the creature. Spock enters and tells McCoy to shoot her because she's threatening the captain. When he pauses, he begins to beat her repeatedly in the face and yelling, "This isn't Nancy. Nancy couldn't take this kind of beating."
So, once again, Star Trek. Beating up ladies.
Yes.
Or trying to.
She then slaps Spock away, transforms into what is the now semi-iconic look of the salt vampire.
You're a bug-eyed monster.
Never actually mentioned by name in the show. Officially known as the creature of M113. And I just learned, colloquially referred to by the crew at the time as the salt sucker, which I actually like a bit better.
Also sounds kind of dirty to me.
A little bit.
Anyway.
The salt vampire then begins feeding on Kirk, and McCoy shoots it. At which point it turns back into Nancy, continues begging for its life. McCoy says, "Forgive me," and then shoots it again to kill it. We then cut to the bridge, where everything seems fine. Kirk says that he is thinking of the buffalo.
Buffalo, roaming.
And then orders Warp 1.
Warp 1, engage, or something.
Yes. And that's the end. That's the Mantrap, first episode of Star Trek.
And you forgot the dramatic rear shot of the engines as they go to warp.
That's true. They have to watch the engines.
We have FTL travel. Hooray!
Now, let's see. I struggle here. Because I really... My idea for this show that I wanted us to do is something that I didn't see a lot of other discourse on. Is just examining the place and uses of science fiction in general in our culture over time.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a sci-fi show.
Not really this episode. But yeah, yeah.
It's a monster show with sci-fi stuff in it.
Yeah, you know, sort of the trope of the monster of the week. It happens fairly often in Star Trek, especially in the original series. But yeah, it's sort of, okay, you have the trappings of sci-fi. There's a spaceship, there's beaming, there's laser beams. But it's mainly about a monster that's going around stalking people.
Yeah, and it's weird. There were like two or three bits that we mentioned a little bit, and I'll expand on. There's a couple of places where you could see they sort of tried. But I feel like this got bogged down in rewrites. Because I was doing a bit of research. This episode, the original script treatment, which is a word I'm going to use a lot because it's sort of a TV writing thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of between an outline and a final script. So the original treatment by a guy called Lee Irwin included the salt vampire and was based on Roddenberry's idea for a man-trapping illusion monster.
No, it is sort of there.
Yes, that's sort of there. But the original idea was for illusions to kind of become more and more realistic and trap people until they're struggling to distinguish between reality and illusion.
Which is kind of an interesting idea.
Yes.
Yet sort of, yeah, because, you know, that definitely is more of the sci-fi sort of deal there. Because you start questioning your reality, start questioning everything, and you maybe start making mistakes.
Yeah, that could have been a much more interesting episode.
Anyhow, how can you tell that this crew member that you know that seems to be trying to help you right now, it's not just an illusion and it's just something that's about to try to kill you the moment you drop your guard?
Yes, but NBC apparently said they were doing too many illusion episodes. So the original script treatment, which included the first version of the salt vampire, was then given to a guy called Clayton Johnson. This is his only writing credit on Star Trek, even though they wanted to get him for more episodes. The script was then rewritten by Gene Roddenberry, which is a phrase that I'm going to use in almost every episode.
You know, he has his fingerprints on a little everything.
Yes. Clayton said that he believed the rewrite diminished the story.
Well, it was a little bit more limited, perhaps, than that original scope, you could say, as we just went over.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure what Clayton's original script was, because that would have been different than the illusionary idea.
Oh, yes.
So, but I'm just not sure, because they tried to keep some of the illusion stuff in there with the salt monster, but they didn't really do much with it, and it's very inconsistent throughout the episode.
Is it just targeting men? Is it also targeting ladies? Well, see if they're her as, like, suggesting yes, but, you know, it's, so it's not necessarily a man specifically trapped, like, male, but, it's a situation that's sort of muddled, ambiguous, and could have been done so much better, I think.
Yeah, it could have, really. And then just the idea of, like, how, you know, does it have to take the form of a real person? Apparently not for the one thing with Uhura, but then apparently mm-hmm. it does the rest of the time. Just odd in general.
A little bit. I guess maybe one interesting thing, when Kirk originally saw older Nancy, he never had seen Nancy. Yet, as far as the audience point of view goes, it is still the same actress playing the old and the young versions. It just, you know, Kirk just sort of kind of already sees her like that.
Yeah.
Just kind of curious to me.
So I guess we should just go into kind of, like, I don't feel there are really intentional themes in this episode.
Not really, no.
So some of the unintentional themes, or the you know, tertiary themes, I guess. Blatant sexism and misogyny.
Yep. You know, it's in my notes here. You know, everyone's just kind of mildly horny and really obvious about it.
Yeah, everyone is kind of mildly horny. Like, Every crew member.
Except for Spock.
Uhura for the entire episode. Like,
it's like, Uhura, why are you hitting on Spock? He's not going to bite.
Yeah,
he doesn't
and then
get it.
Apparently wandering down the hallway, imagining tall Swahili dude.
Is space this lonely, guys? Really?
Like women do. Just wander down the hallway, imagining the man of their dreams in a work scenario.
You know, there's people, you know, hanging out in the hallways, like going about their jobs. They seem to be apparently doing it, and everyone's doing this as well. Everyone just sort of daydreaming, and that's why everyone has to be working constantly.
Yes, apparently. So, you have the whole thing with the salt monster. It starts out as your standard kind of Black Widow seductress trope.
A little bit.
It then turns into Crewman Green, which is the first time we find that the monster can actually present as either male or female.
Mm-hmm. So it goes from Black Widow to Infiltrator.
Yes.
Unknown agent.
But not well.
Yeah.
So it goes from Black Widow seductress to just creeper.
Yep. And it's sort of the first time in all of Star Trek where everyone is just kind of bad at this whole realizing there's something wrong going on.
Yes, everyone's just, you know,
completely oblivious.
Crewman Green, are you okay? Crewman Green says nothing. It's like, okay, good talk.
You're obviously okay then, because you did not say that you're having a bad time.
Yes.
I'm okay with this.
Apparently, like, the only... I was talking this over with my girlfriend the other day, and she pointed out that the only really good interaction that they have is actually the one with Uhura and unnamed imaginary crewman. Because while that is still a bit creepy, he's a little bit forceful. The scene would have, like, I was calling some uncomfortableness there. But yes. That's more just in line with he wants to eat her. The actual flirting that they're doing is actually kind of the better end of that they show in the episode.
Yes, so less nervous twitching, licking of lips, more, hi there, how you doing? I'm going to get up in your space. I'm going to talk in your native language for a little bit and be all like, yeah.
Like, they kind of get into a little bit of the, like, well, it's a sentient creature, should we kill it later on? Mm-hmm. But, like, as I was going through again, and it took me a minute to remember, none of them knowingly engage with the creature.
Not really, no.
They kind of talk it over when McCoy is the creature, but none of them know this.
Shouldn't we, like, treat it as an intelligent being? Shouldn't we, like, I don't know, give it an option other than killing people? Guys, hint, hint, guys.
And they're just like, nope, it's got to die.
We have to murder our way out of this problem. Sorry.
And then right at the end, they try to introduce some environmental themes, I guess.
Yep.
Which is, this is something that pops up in the show, because environmentalism was a big deal in the 60s. The book Silent Spring had been written in 1962 by Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. And that details the dangers of DDT, which, if you're unfamiliar, because you might not be, it's a slightly older pesticide.
Yes, a little toxic.
Yes, it's very toxic. They found that it was entering the food chain, and basically it decimated local bird populations.
There's a song from the 60s called Big Yellow Taxi, which mentioned DDT if you are from that era.
Yes, which also kind like has some, you know, environmental messaging. So, you know, environmentalism, ecological disasters. This is one of the first times they're starting to be noticed.
Yeah, because the guy talks about, yeah, these creatures apparently have killed off their entire planet.
Yes,
and just sort of everything's dead now except this one last one.
Yeah, and like important to remember. From our perspective now, at the time, environmentalism was not a partisan issue.
Nope.
Like the first environmental policies were put into place by President Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is the guy who signed off on the Environmental Protection Agency and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. So this was not really like, you know, the show gets called for having fairly liberal ideals, and I think that it does. But in this, like, this one here is not. This is just, like, the Star of environmentalism in the country. But they, again, I don't want to call it stumbling at the first hurdle. They don't even like look at the first hurdle.
It's like, well, okay, we can kind of consider this, but it's more of a, you know, a side note. It's something that you guys can think about at home, but we're not going to really focus on it too much.
Yeah, and this also begins this kind of theme in Star Trek, which I find kind of interesting for the original series, and that it's a utopian future world. It's the look at what we can achieve as humanity, but everything's dead.
Yep.
It's like, remember the last buffalo, which apparently went extinct in this timeline. And later on, the really, really famous thing in the movies is the whales are extinct and other things are extinct. It's basically also doing the you screwed up Earth back in your time, stop it idea of future thinking.
Yeah, everything got really bad before we figured out how to do the good. And this sort of theme runs off, you know, even through, I've been mentioning on my Twitter that I've been rewatching and in some cases watching the first time all of Deep Space Nine. And what was it? Sorry, I just had a brain fart. Give me a moment. Keep talking.
So like the environmental themes show up later in the show. There's episodes that include more ecology and environmentalism, but the only real passing thing this gets is this is the last of its kind, like the mighty buffalo that we killed off on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to be a lot of point to it, because they never go into an ethical dilemma through the entire show. There's no, like, should we kill off the last of a species? We would be responsible for the extinction of this species. This is an intelligent creature that we are, you know, killing without a second thought. There's no ethical quandary.
Yeah, it's just sort of completely glossed over. Oh, I figured out my brain fart
yes.
there. kind of on the theme of, you know, everything got way worse before it got better. Things like the war with the genetic Superman and things like that, all that stuff that apparently happened in the 90s. And then in Deep Space Nine, stuff like the Bell riots and the sort of sanctuary sort of territories in the big cities.
Yeah,
you know, all this stuff.
Hmm.
You know, all this is sort of in the same theme that, you know, before we get to this utopia where apparently we don't have any sort of ethical dilemmas when there should be ethical dilemmas. we had to go through all this terrible stuff that we managed to survive to get to our principles. And then you get to, you know, moments like this where it's like, did we really get through it all?
Yes. Though that's a good point, because it's a really interesting way that Star Trek plays with its far future timeline. Because it's obviously doing the look at what humanity can be, but it's also using a lot of dystopian fiction in its own history.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, if you keep going this way, here's all the terrible stuff that's going to happen. Doesn't this make you want to change what you're doing? But also look at these awesome ideals you could be upholding.
Yeah, we can get here. Now, there is perhaps maybe the unfortunate side effect that some folks then look at this sort of situation and be like, oh, so you mean we need to make things worse before they get better?
Yeah.
which is really, really kind of annoying and sinister sort of way to look at the idealism of Star Trek.
That's true.
I have run into people who are like, yeah, the only way we can really figure out how to fix the world is to destroy everything, tear it down first. And like, no, that's how everyone dies.
Yes. It would be nice to avoid World War III.
Yes.
That'd be great.
The Atomic Holocaust? No, that's a bad thing.
Yes.
Come on, guys.
Oh. And then so I wanted to mention the conference room scene, because you know, mm-hmm. I've been prepping for doing the Star Trek run. And
yes.
Star Trek is very much a ethical show. There's a lot of like ethics and philosophy and things in a lot of the episodes. And it's very much kind of framed as a virtue ethics versus utilitarianism sort of show, kind of represented by the interplay that you often get between Kirk and Spock. Though
mm-hmm.
So this episode had neither, because both of them were doing the exact opposite of what you would expect them to do in the situation in the conference room.
So we're not going to think about, okay, there's the utility of just sort of kill it and make it go away versus the idealistic, you know, even kind of maybe prime directive sort of option of this is a creature that is not of us. We should let it be and figure out a way to live, you know, coexist peacefully.
Well, see, this is the thing. Like, neither of them should have wanted to kill it.
Yeah.
Like, virtuously, killing things is wrong. So if you can avoid it, that's something good to do. Utilitarianism posits that you should bring the maximum number of happiness to the maximum amount of people. If we're expanding people to mean all sentient beings, which we should in this kind of future setting, then a sentient thinking creature deserves happiness just as much as anyone else, and giving it its food supply makes it non-dangerous.
Yep.
But this is something that's not actually considered.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so it's potentially dangerous around us, but we can maybe beam it back down and leave it a huge supply of salt. And we'll just occasionally send people over here to check in on it and provide it a new new shipment of salt every once in a while just to keep it going.
Yeah, so it's... I don't know. It's, I guess it's implied that they shouldn't leave it alone because Crater says that it needs love as much as it needs salt, which is sort of a cloyingly awkward line.
I think he's just having wishful thinking.
Possibly, yes. And I don't...
He's in love.
Yeah. I don't. They were simultaneously trying to make us feel very sympathetic to the salt vampire creature while also telling us how they needed to kill it and they really had no other options.
Like, we have a tragedy here. We need to feel bad about doing this horrible thing. Let's make everything sound like that's the only conclusion.
Yes. And you know what? I'm honestly just struggling to find anything extra to say. This is like... This isn't a particularly good episode of television by any measure. It's not really dealing with any interesting science fiction themes or like themes in general. It just doesn't have a theme. Yeah. It's too muddled. It's trying to introduce and then immediately drop too many little bitty themes. It was kind of an interesting thing that was pointed out to me when I was having a discussion with this in preparation for the episode. Like, we have to look at this in the context of Star Trek as a franchise. Because if this episode were not connected to Star Trek as this megalithic identity, no one would remember it.
Yeah, pretty much. It's like, okay, here's a bug-eyed monster. It was a science fiction show in the 60s. It was in color. And what else? There's an alien or two, maybe, I think, and some really awkward creepiness going on here and there.
Yeah, that's about it.
That's about it. No real lessons to be learned. No sort of point to be sort of pushed. It just sort of does its thing. It's just a mishmash of things. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. All right. So we both ran out of things to say.
Well, I guess maybe I do have one sort of thing we could maybe talk about is how does it hold up in terms of introducing the audience to the show?
Yeah.
For that, I'd actually say it's okay. Not great, but it hits up a few of the important things.
So I kept reading things that said this was a really good introduction, and they posited Kirk and McCoy's interplay. Mm-hmm. Which I do think was decent. It was well acted. It was fairly well written. They do come off kind of as old friends who hate each other a little bit.
Yeah.
it introduces... let's see. It introduces four of the... Of like the five or six main cast that you would see in each episode.
Yep.
So I guess in that front it does fairly well. I would expect this to be a Monster of the Week show if I like saw this as the first episode.
Yeah, it's like, oh, so we're going to get some sort of creature each week. I'll tune in on this. Be good to have on while I'm eating my dinner or something like that in the evenings. Sure, I'll take it in.
Yeah, so I'm honestly torn on this one. Because I feel like it did an okay job at introducing some of the characters.
But it you know, kind of failed, though, at introducing anything else.
Yeah, like it didn't really say, you know, how is this distinguished from anything else that's on TV? It's basically a Western with, like, you know, lasers instead of guns.
So, overall, kind of unremarkable.
Yes, which is, it did come out to, you know, middling reviews. So I guess that's to be expected.
And this was the safe choice to be the first episode.
Yes. So I guess, since we both kind of ran out of things to say, some random trivia. Mm-hmm. Alternate names for this episode, which I did like, because Mantrap is a horrible name for this episode.
A little bit.
It's just awful. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just horrible. It is, in fact, a holdover from the original idea where the illusionary things would be trapping people. So alternate names included the woman with the harp. So I guess that thing she entered with was supposed to be a harp.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember a harp.
Yeah, I didn't mention this, the thing, but when Nancy first enters, she's carrying something that looks like a decorative piece of architecture.
Oh, yeah.
And she's touching it in such a way that I thought it might have been playing the music from the beginning, but then it's never mentioned or done again or remarked upon.
Maybe it was an earlier draft had that actually be the case.
Yeah. And then maybe the harp was supposed to do something. I don't know. My favorite alternate episode name, which they should have gone with, the fake McCoy.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because there is an unreal McCoy there. There's a fake McCoy. There's,
yes,
a guy who is pretending to be McCoy, who is certainly not McCoy, and maybe some sort of Saul vampire.
Or it might have been the unreal McCoy, but either one would have worked. Yes. Yeah.
I guess maybe in terms of the mechanics of the monster, though, it does sort of make me wonder if it's eating all the salt. Salt, you know, sodium chloride. Is it making it not be salt anymore?
Yeah, I was wondering about this, and I did, like I said, I didn't want to get into the nitpicky, like, oh my god, the science doesn't work out thing.
I know it's Star Trek, and that's kind of most of science, yeah. Honestly.
But, like, so what, depending on what they mean by salt, this thing needs to eat an absurd amount.
Yes.
Because it kills, like, four people throughout the course of the episode. If you listen to the captain's log things, I guess the episode is supposed to take 3 or 4 days.
Oh, yeah. I guess I wasn't paying too close attention to the actual start dates, but yeah.
Yeah, so like the first start date and the last start date are, you know, I think like 4 days apart, if I'm remembering start date notation correctly. It gets salt from the little salt tablets, which actually was pointed out to me that like salt pills and stuff used to be a thing in the 60s.
I think my mom mentioned taking those at some point.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons they kept mentioning them as a like thing that you would definitely need is like salt tablets, because you would be taking like salt pills to work in the heat and things. It was an incredibly bad idea, but it was, you know, medical practice at the time.
Yes, there's a lot of medical practices in every era that are kind of questionable when you look back at them.
I was doing some research on how much salt is actually inside of a person.
Oh, we're going full Metal Alchemist here now.
A little bit. Excellent. Well, it kind of depends. If you're talking about just sodium chloride, it's probably a few tablespoons. But if you're talking about, you know, sodium or chloride or various salts or, you know, whatever is in your body actually being used, it can be up to, like, a couple pounds, depending on how big of a person you're dealing with.
I like me some sodium iodine.
So how much salt does this thing need?
Apparently a lot. Maybe by the time they got to the planet, it was actually, like, super starved. Like, you know, it would take maybe a pill a day, but, you know, it's been out for weeks or something like that. So it's like, I'm hungry. I'm jonesing for some salt.
Yes, possibly. I don't know. I feel like that's another one. Like, I don't need mechanics of things fully explained to me, But if you want a monster to be, like, scary at all or worrying, you need to kind of explain some very basic mechanics.
Yes, as opposed to it's spooky and it does this.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. It just sort of does a thing. Okay.
Well, unless you have anything particularly of interest to say, this is probably a good portion to wrap up. I think it's been about an hour for the episode.
I guess I could compare it to other terrible monster of the week for a different series, but that's about all I could think of right now.
Well, I don't know. This the monster of the week thing in general is just very strange. I feel like it's kind of atypical of what the show is trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I guess it was a horrible first episode for me.
I'd say that I had some fun with this just because how ridiculous it was. But as far as, you know, being a otherwise enjoyable episode, I was pretty meh.
Yeah. Well, speaking of horrible and cheesiness, next week we will be doing episode 2 in the original broadcast run, which was Charlie X.
Charlie X.
Do you remember anything about this episode?
No.
I remember it involved the first appearance of the Q-like beings.
Oh, the super powerful beings from beyond all time and reason?
Yes. It's as far as I remember, it is the first Star Trek introduction of the random teenager mindset person with too much power.
Oh, is this the one with the kid? He's like, and you know, he's like running around and like gets these superpowers and he's like kind of also kind of creepy like Mr. Green was in this episode.
I think so. If I haven't rewatched it yet, but from what I remember, I think, yeah, we've got another creeper episode.
Because I think I do remember this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember liking it very much.
Ugh. Oh, well.
But we'll see.
That is next week.
Yes, join us next time on Watchers of Tomorrow, where we watch Star Trek, the original series episode, Charlie X. Tune in that time, next time, with us together once more. Been listening to Watchers of Tomorrow, a podcast on science fiction media. You may find Gepwin on youtube.com/Gepwin and on Twitter at Gepwin, spelled G-E-P-W-I-N. You may find me, Dr. Izix, on youtube.com/Dr. Izix, spelled D-R-I-Z-I-X-S, and Twitter at Izix, L-P. Music is Waveform by DRKRN and Morey's Principle by the same. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure to subscribe for more, and share the experience with your friends, families, enemies, and alien overlords. If you feel you are suffering from transporter syndrome, please be aware that the next time you step off the transporter, the you that is will no longer exist.